like better than bacon and lettuce and homegrown tomatoes. Up in the morning, out in the garden, get you ripe when you don't get a hard one. Plant them in the spring, eat them in the summer. All winter without them's a culinary bummer. I forget all about the sweating and digging every time I go out and pick me a pig. Homegrown tomatoes, homegrown tomatoes.
All right, friends, it's Thursday afternoon. That means it's time for another installment of In the Garden with Master Gardener Ed Bajarski and me, Orin Pearson, here in the KFSK studios. We do want to thank the Flower Farm for helping underwrite this program. They're down there at 6 Rory's Road, Papke's Landing, and this Saturday they will be selling their colorful bouquets at the Petersburg Market. That's Saturday from 10 till 1 at the John Hansen Senior Community Hall. And, so thank you to the Flower Farm. And I think we've got Master Gardener Ed Bajarski on the line here. We'll see if we can pull him up. Ed, how are you?
Well, I'm trying to stay dry, which is kind of a contrast with our several previous weeks of programming, but that's okay. We actually see some water flowing down through the ditches and the creeks. And there's some waterfalls again, which haven't been seen in several weeks.
Wow.
So it's a good thing.
It's a good thing. But it does change things rather drastically in the garden, doesn't it?
Oh, it does. Yes, I know. It's a whole different crop of pests and opportunities, I guess. But, you know, it's good that we're having the rain. We needed it very badly.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm not going to complain as long as it doesn't. Well, yeah, we can hope that it doesn't last forever.
Yeah,
it'll be a nice day Saturday, I hope.
Yeah, we're anticipating the same and hoping for that. That'll be nice. Yeah, you mentioned the how the pests change.
Yes, indeed. You know, otherwise we have when it's dry, we have the flies. Mm-hmm. And actually, a friend of mine was saying it's kind of a wasp problem. The wasps are good in one way in that they are pollinators mostly, but they also don't take kindly to being disturbed.
Mm-hmm.
So you've got to really be careful around those, especially some of the ground nesting ground wasps or hornets, mm-hmm. whichever you prefer to call them. And then there's also the above ground ones, the ones that are hanging underneath your eaves or sometimes even inside the greenhouse.
Right.
Can be a very exciting experience. For you, should you be so unfortunate as to disturb them.
Yeah, that's always a bit of an unwelcome arrival, the wasp's nest.
You know, they like the heat. They like it warm and dry, and they're out there moving around. And of course, when it gets to this cooler weather like this, this slows them down. So if you have to deal with them in some fashion, you know, better to deal with them on the cooler days.
Mm.
And then, of course, there's they've been kind of absent for much of the summer, or at least hiding out better than we don't see them so much. But the old slugs have been coming out of the woodwork with this weather we're having.
Exactly.
So it is definitely probably just a few general reminders to folks. And, of course, as we're harvesting, should be doing our cleanup work,
mm-hmm.
which also helps in keeping either slug numbers down or removing places for them to hide.
Right.
On the other hand, if you give them a place to hide and put some slug bait underneath there, well, then they may never emerge again.
Well, that's a good strategy. That's true.
And that's something, if we're using slug bait, we do want to be careful. Which kind we use as far as safety, both for us and for pets, birds, other wildlife, too. You know, so we don't want to, just like with any other pesticide, we want to be targeting the critters that we want to get rid of. So for the slugs, they hide out underneath boards, in between rocks, underneath leaves. And that's a good way to find a place, whether you're going out there and just doing some direct control, say either going out in the evening and removing them with prejudice with your sharp scissors, or dropping them in a bowl or a bucket with some salt water or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
If you have rhubarb leaves, perhaps, that you've been harvesting your rhubarb.
Mm.
Or like I've lately been harvesting cauliflower. And once we take the cauliflower out, I pull the whole plant out, then those leaves are very attractive to slugs. So if you lay them down kind of at the edge of the garden, that's a place where they can be found if you go looking for them.
Mm-hmm.
Stay with either, you can put some slug bait underneath there, or you can also use some of our ammonia and water spray, just plain old household ammonia, mixed about one part ammonia to one to two parts of water.
Huh.
And you can use that when you see the slugs, just spray them with it.
Right. Okay. So that doesn't
nice
lure
thing about
them.
One advantage: the ammonia is a fertilizer.
Mm.
So, and you've got to be a little careful what kind of plants, if you're spraying them on one of your good plants, something like the cabbage family crops, they're rather waxy leaves. The ammonia and water just slides right off very nicely, beads up and goes off.
Mm.
Usually taking the slug with it. But if you see slugs on softer leaf plants like lettuce or potatoes, those can be hard. The ammonia spray can be a little hard on the leaves and actually turn some of the leaves brown. So that would be, if you're having that problem, you would probably want to dilute the ammonia to 2-to-1 or even 3-to-1. Just less ammonia mixed with your water, so that you don't damage the leaves of the, you know, the slugs may already be trying to damage leaves. We shouldn't be doing more damage.
Right, right. Yeah, maybe those leaves are a little bit under stress anyway.
Well, yeah, if it's been really dry, well, no if about it. It has been very dry. That's a good thing. So the slugs have been stressed. That's a good thing, too.
Oh, true.
But they're also out there. I mean, just in the last few days, the slugs are coming out. And we've seen slugs mating, which, of course, I guess that would give you an opportunity to get 2-for-1 at the time, with your depending what sort of implement or what you're using. But removing them, remove them from the gene pool before they get a chance.
Right.
Now, I have been seeing tiny, tiny little slugs, so certainly there has been, breeding going on this summer already that we've just missed. So just... those are the toughest ones, of course, to deal with. I mean, tiny being like 2 millimeters long, really tiny slugs, but they will grow.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's...
So getting, combat them, in the moist areas, in the places where they're hiding out, that's usually the best way. Again, whether using, you can also use, the old recipe of using some beer, ale beer, leave an inch of beer in the bottom of a beer bottle, and then hide that kind of underneath the leaves of some of your plants.
Mm-hmm.
So it doesn't look like you've had this wild party and the beer bottles have been thrown around by some ne'er-do-wells in your garden. Hide them just, unless, of course, you're happy with that and don't care who sees it.
That's the look you're going for.
What kind of a reputation do you want to foster?
Yeah, yeah, the frat boy garden.
Sure.
I don't know. Anyway, but so that works pretty well, the old beer trap?
It really does. Yeah, I mean, they are attracted, and if folks are, morally opposed to beer for whatever the reason, even use actually making a kind of a sugar water or even a almost like a diluted sourdough mix, because the slugs are attracted apparently to the kind of the yeasty smell also. So you can make up your own solution. Or if you know somebody who makes bad beer, so there are people like that, you can get their bad beer and use it for slug bait. So it doesn't go entirely to waste.
Well, that's a good point, actually. Most homebrew operations, nobody's perfect out there.
If they've
put some work into it, that's a good use.
Rather than forcing yourself or them forcing you to drink their bad beer, say, hey, yeah, sure, I'll take some of that home. And you just don't tell them where it's going.
Yeah, yeah. You're putting it to good use.
Right, exactly.
So
and not offending them too much, unless, of course, they see their hard-earned beer in your yard.
Well, maybe they're listening, and they'll be quietly happy to know that they're a part of the health of your garden.
There you go, exactly. Right, bring them some nice garden produce and say, thanks, this is for that wonderful beer that you gave me.
Yeah, yeah.
Maybe they'll give you some more.
Oh, no. the improved
so
recipe, hopefully.
So it can be an opportunity, maybe, if you're discreet about it.
Sure. So with this beer trap, Does it bump off the slugs when they get in there, or do they just go in there? They pile in.
I don't know if there's actually been any proper studies. There have been actually studies done on brands of beer that they prefer. But the actual mechanism, whether they actually get, they're attracted by the beer, get in there and drink, and drown, and whether it's alcohol poisoning or otherwise, I'm not really sure of that.
Gotcha. Okay. Well, that's good. That's a win-win. That probably works better than a sugar water in that sense, then. It's not just tempting them, but it's also finishing them off.
Yeah. Well, it was interesting, at least the one study or the one report of a study that I read, they were actually using near beer, you know, or light, you know, really light beer, or the stuff, or even the non-alcoholic stuff, which somehow, well, because I don't know, that might ruin your reputation being seen buying that stuff too. So I don't know.
Littered everywhere. Well, okay, so that's a good approach, and then just kind of removing by hand around folks living near the water anyway. Just a bucket of salt water seems like it would work pretty well.
Oh yeah. That works fine, because if you try just, and I've done this, just drop them into a bucket of fresh water, you know, they kind of slowly fall to the bottom, and they crawl back up out of there.
Yeah.
So that doesn't work by itself. So doing the little bit of salt water, or if you, I mean, what can I say? For men at least, you know, you pee in a bucket, and that's really salty water too. So throw them in that, and then you can take that stuff and carefully dilute it a bit once they're dead, of course, and pour it back on the garden for more fertilizer.
Huh. Sure. Yeah, that's ammonia too, right?
Huh. Yeah, I mean, you want to be, again, discretion is important here.
Yeah. Okay, well, these are all important things to be thinking about as far as the new rain-awoken slugs who are making their move right around harvest time too, isn't it? I mean, certainly it's a good time to be looking in the garden and maybe pulling some stuff out, I imagine. I mean, we've talked a lot about the things you'd want to be pulling out before the new arriving rain kind of changes. I mean, obviously cherries, ripe berries, garlic.
Yeah.
Hopefully people have seen the forecast.
And one that I've really seen just in the last few days, again, with the heavy rains we've had, I've got cabbages. In fact, I've got to cut cabbages today because they are starting to split. They were relatively mature with the heat. You know, we were watering them, but they are now wanting to split. And that both, unfortunately, well, for several reasons. You want to pick them now. I've got friends who are waiting for some of these because they shared some plants with me. But also we'll be making coleslaw, and we'll also be probably making some sauerkraut, although the later cabbage tends to be better for that rather than these early cabbage.
Right.
But then the other thing is, you know, with the cracking of the cabbage, that also means that the slugs can get into them more easily.
Totally.
So again, that's, you know, one more reason that we want to be careful with those. Get them out of the ground. Get them, well, yes. And actually, you don't even need to take them completely out of the ground. Unlike with cauliflower, with cabbages, if you cut off the cabbage, leave the roots in place, and some of the lower leaves, especially with these early ones, they will actually sprout more, basically baby cabbages. And I've had some that will grow. You know, here it is early August. By the end of September and October, because they're quite cold hardy, having fist size or larger, two or three more little cabbages from that same plant.
Nice.
Assuming that you don't have, you know, assuming that these were not, hopefully they were not damaged by root maggots and such, and that would be something that you might notice if, say, if while you're cutting the cabbage, the whole plant comes out of the ground real easily. That may tell you that, well, they have been damaged, the roots have been damaged, and then may not be able to hang on and continue to feed these tiny little cabbages that would grow. That might be an opportunity then, again, use a little bit of liquid fertilizer, weed juice, or otherwise, give them a light feeding, and then again, that will be a chance for them to produce some more from, well, by that same root system in that location.
Mm-hmm.
And those little cabbages are great.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, you can pick them and just chop them up into salads or whatever you want to use your cabbage for, of course. And they work quite nicely. They can be single servings. You can steam a whole one or just cut it in half and steam it and put something tasty on it. You know, butter and, you know, garlic butter or something like that is always a favorite.
Mm-hmm.
So, again, it's an opportunity when you're doing this harvesting to be selectively harvesting.
And is it the case that when you're harvesting the cabbage, today or right around this time, is it sometimes you don't really see the root maggot until, you know, you've maybe pulled a plant out or you've seen that it's loose and kind of
right.
damaged in there, but you don't necessarily see the root maggot from above?
The hot weather should have shown you that you were having a problem, because with the hot weather, the cabbage would, if the roots, cabbage, broccoli, cauliflower, any of these, that in hot weather, the whole plant wilts.
Right.
Because the roots have been damaged enough that they cannot move, they cannot bring up, even if you're watering, you know, daily or whatever in the hot weather, mm-hmm. that they just cannot pick up the moisture that they need.
Mm-hmm.
So that's an indication that you've got the problem.
Yeah.
So that would be an opportunity for you. If you know that you've got a problem, you may be harvesting them, knowing that you've got root maggots, that's worth getting them out, getting the whole root system out,
mm-hmm.
and even to maybe digging out some of the soil, which may have some of those root maggots in it still,
mm-hmm.
and actually dispose of that soil.
Right. It's nearly certain that it does, right? I mean, if they've grown there, the soil...
Yes.
You know,
and again, whether they've finished their life cycle and may have... And normally, they would then pupate... You know, move back into the soil to pupate and then to stay there over the winter until emerging next spring.
Mm-hmm.
Or if, I mean, I'm not going to predict the weather at this point, but if we had a warm spell again, say if we had a week of really warm weather, then you might actually get them to reemerge and then go looking for more of the cabbage family crops.
Mm-hmm.
And last year I did. I mean, I did plant a later crop of broccoli. And more kale about this time of year, and they did get infested with the root maggots again.
Mm.
So I was unhappily made aware of that.
Yeah.
So again, it's worth your watching and continue to use Remay. Say if you do some new planting, say up into mid September or so, and that hopefully will get you then through. We hope, get you through that second potential infestation. With this weather we've had, who knows? But you know how cool last year was, and this year being warmer, they, even though they may have started out late, then they've come on fast, and like I say, may do it again to us.
Yeah. How are things looking for you this year? Like you say, last year they were there. Were you able to...
This year I worked rather hard at trying to avoid the problem. So I was very careful. So when I got the plants into the ground, I was using actually three different methods. So I first put some diatomaceous earth around the stems of each plant. And then on top of that, I went to my local barber shop and got human hair, cut hair, and put a kind of a ring of that right up around the stems of the plants. So, and then over the whole thing, I've then put the Remay. And beautiful, magnificent cabbages, cauliflower, broccoli, and all that sort of thing this year.
Good.
So I have not, whereas I did plant some kale back in, I think it was in May, in one of my hoop houses, which is open-ended, and that got infested by root maggots, which probably came from kale that was, overwintered, unfortunately.
Okay.
So they were definitely in the neighborhood, but they did not seem to infest my more prized broccoli to start with, and then now we're eating cauliflower and about to start on the cabbages, and there are, in the same bed, there are also Brussels sprouts. So once everything else gets harvested, the Brussels sprouts will stay there till who knows, into November probably, or maybe Thanksgiving if we're lucky.
Hmm. So which crops are the ones that these root maggots really go after?
Okay, so we have the cabbage root maggots, and so those will attack everything in the cabbage family plant, which includes, you know, you may very well see root maggots in radishes. If you get wormy radishes, turnips, rutabagas, all of those can have the problem. Then the broccoli, cauliflower, cabbage, and Brussels sprouts, it seems like to less extent. Cauliflower seems to be very much a favorite of them. Kale, somewhat, and it depends, varieties of kale. Does seem to make a difference. They seem to have their own preferences, I guess. I've heard, have not seen, that some folks who grow horseradish, believe it or not, is in the cabbage family. You know, if you actually see them flowering, you would see that they have the four petals, either yellow or white flowers. And I've heard but haven't seen this, I don't grow the stuff myself, that they may be susceptible to the cabbage root maggot.
Wow. Do you know offhand which varieties of kale are more resilient to the cabbage root maggot?
I don't. That would be doing the research and actually even planting some. That would be an interesting one. I mean, for me, I only grow the red Russian kale.
Yeah.
And so that one is... It's the best flavored to me. It's hardy enough. I mean, there are some that are even more hardy as far as winter temperatures go. But I'm happy with that one. So, and I know that it seemed like early years they were not so attractive, but it has become, I don't know if they've become more attractive or if the root maggots just go whatever they can get to. If my other stuff is covered up, well, then they go for the red Russian kale.
Mm. Oh, I see. Okay, so it's not the top of their preference. It's not their favorite thing on the menu, but they will go for it if
and then we and again, I don't really know, but we do have, I don't know how attractive they are to root maggots, but we do have several different species of wild mustards. From there's the tiny, little tiny one that only grows, you know, 3 to 5 inches tall. It has, you know, the seeds pop. And can get in their eyes and be really annoying. Very small leaves, sometimes called pennycress. On up, and there's another, a larger wild mustard, often grows along the beaches, has, you know, it's a edible green, big dark green leaves and yellow flowers also. But again, I'm not certain whether those can be kind of a, another overwintering crop that the root maggots may feed on in, you know, if they lack some other cabbage. And it kind of depends on your local area too, you know, what other people are growing too. And if you could work with everybody in your neighborhood, I suppose, to control them, because the little flies will emerge in the springtime and go looking. And if everybody has their stuff covered up, well, maybe you could, you know, bring them a little bit more under control.
Yeah, is there any point in, like, luring them away from your cabbage beds or anything by...
Well, I've had some folks, and this is, I remember seeing an organic gardening magazine, among others, to actually deliberately plant something like radishes. Apparently radishes are more attractive. Huh. So you plant some radishes, say, at the same time as you would be planting your broccoli and cabbages, and apparently the root maggots go for those first. So that's one, and then, so then you... take advantage of that. Use it as a trap crop, it's called.
Right.
You know, whatever the most attractive plant is. And you just pull them out, check them, seeing that they're getting infested, and then pull them out and, again, you know, try to dispose of the soil.
Yeah.
In the hopes of, you know, knocking down your numbers.
Right.
In your, you know, your particular garden or your neighborhood, maybe.
Yeah. Okay. That's a really useful tip, I think. And so we did also just get a call here. I'm going to pull on the line and see what they're looking for as far as knowledge goes. Hello there, line one. Have you got a question for Ed Byarski?
Hi, Ed. This is Craig Olson. And,
good afternoon.
I've got a question for Ed in terms of forsythia.
Uh-huh.
And whether or not it's going to be viable here. Somebody does have a forsythia bush in town, and I've got my choice between ordering a couple of different kinds.
Okay. First question is, yes, it grows. Grows well in Juneau. If you have choices for where to plant it, I would say plant it in a spot that's sheltered from the coldest winds, the coldest north winds. Because since they bloom so early, you know, they can be blooming in a nice warm spot in March or April, those buds become very tender. And that's what can happen here, certainly in Juneau, that the buds get frosted or damaged. And even though the plant grows just fine, you just don't get flowers. And face it, a forsythia bush isn't beautiful enough to grow without getting flowers.
Okay, and do you know of a species that does better here than others?
I'm trying to remember one. It was, I want to say Meadow Gold, but I don't know if that's quite the right name that I have grown and planted, seen here. And the other thing, too, is you mentioned that you know of other plant or plants in Petersburg. They're relatively easy to start from cuttings. So, I mean, you could take cuttings even now of some of the new wood, and if you use some rooting hormone or gel or something like that, you could actually root your own, although it would still take a couple, 2-3 years to get to a size that would be likely to be blooming. But if the plants that are there in Petersburg do bloom, then you know you're getting the right variety. So there's an advantage in that if you're depending on how patient you are.
Unfortunately, they pruned the plant and it died.
So much for that idea. Okay. So then, go and check on if you're doing research for Scythia, and actually do, I would say if you do a web search, search for cold hardy forsythia, or the most cold hardy ones, and then take a look to see what's available there.
Okay, and then another one is that people are asking for is honeyberry.
Okay.
And is that, I'm not familiar with it, is that a desirable fruit that it gives out? And I assume that would do well here.
Yes, it does. It does grow well, and if you want to plant two different varieties for cross pollination, so you know again when you're doing your research to see the different kinds, check on some of those. I have here in Juneau at least. They're actually growing them commercially up on. There's a place. Boy, I can't remember the guy's name. But on the Kenai Peninsula, actually has a commercial orchard or whatever of them, and he makes. I've actually eaten some of the jelly. It was really tasty stuff. We have a few at the Jensen Olsen Arboretum in Juneau. He's got I think 3 different varieties. They were ripe. In fact, they were ripe 2 weeks ago already. So they are a fairly early ripening. Well, there's various different ones. Some are earlier than others. But the ones there were quite good. And honeyberries are kind of strange, but they are an edible honeysuckle. And another name, another thing that you might look for, this fellow in the Kenai did a program some years back at a garden conference I was at. He was recommending the Norwegian or Swedish Scandinavian varieties rather than some Japanese varieties, because supposedly they were a little more hardy. And there's a different name. I don't know if you've run across this in your research. They're also called Haskup, H-A-S-K-A-P. Again, I'm not sure if that's Norwegian or Swedish. Perhaps some of your local folks may be able to tell you that.
Okay, well, thanks very much.
Okay, good luck.
Thanks for the question, Greg. Those are both very interesting. Honeyberry.
It's a different. It's a tart. It's a weirdly shaped kind of a long, bulging, cylindrical shaped berry, an inch to an inch and a half long. And when they turn from green to red to dark purple. They're tasty.
But you were saying they necessarily cross-pollinate across varieties? They don't...
Yes, exactly. Kind of like with apples. You know, you do want to have two different varieties mm-hmm. planted. And they get to be, the ones I've seen at least and I've heard about, they say plant them 5 feet apart because they'll get to be 5 feet tall and wide.
Wow.
So good size, kind of like the size of a good currant bush, currant or a gooseberry bush.
Hmm. Okay.
And as far as I know, well, this fellow from the Kenai said every critter likes to eat the berries. Everything from the birds to the bears to the moose. Well, I suppose the moose probably eat the plants and everything else. So he has to have an electric fence around them and a mesh fence as well as netting over the top. So.
Wow. Okay. Well, they sound pretty darn interesting. Almost like little super sweet cherry tomatoes or something. Little.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know. But anyway, he said they were, the critters like them.
Huh. Cool. And so if they're cross variety pollinating, do you end up with a little bit of a sort of roll of the dice hybridizing each time it bears fruit? Or
Well, no. You don't have to. That isn't something to worry about when the whatever the plant, the variety of plant that you plant, just like with Red Delicious apples mm-hmm. or with Rainier cherries or Bing cherries.
Mm-hmm.
So even though those plants need a pollinator, the fruits they produce will be true to the tree.
Oh,
but if you took the seeds from that fruit and grew them, then you would get some other different, again, those seeds would be hybrids themselves, but the fruits would come true.
Gotcha.
Same thing like with squash or tomatoes. You know, if you plant a certain kind of zucchini squash, that's what kind you will get.
Perfect.
But if you have more than one variety of them that then crosses or, you know, and rigor squash, winter squash are really do that too. You plant seeds from one squash and you can get five different kinds of squash
right.
in the next fall from whatever grows.
Totally. Okay, that makes good sense.
Which is fascinating.
Yeah, that is so interesting. You can make your own special, bit of an experiment into your own regional specialty
of
honeyberry.
Your very own hybrid that you name after your loved one or significant other or whatever. Yes, sure.
Wonderful. Well, maybe on that charming note, that's where we can leave it for today. And we'll pick it up again next week. We'll see what a week of rain does to the world. And we'll dive back in, maybe leave people with the note that as the temperatures are plummeting, really, greenhouses are getting real cooled off, and so airflow.
Yeah, you got to make sure, work on your ventilation.
Yeah.
Just like ventilation for heat, got to ventilate for moisture.
Yeah, because this is when the sort of molds and funguses, mildew, gray mold type stuff is really going to just be looking for its new home on your leaves.
Okay.
All right, well, till next week then, Ed. Thanks so much for taking the time to share your expertise with us.
You're welcome.
Okay, till then.
All right, bye.
Bye now. All right. In the Garden with Master Gardener Ed Bajarski, and I'm Oren here in the studio. And thank you to the Flower Farm. If you want to get yourself one of their colorful bouquets, they're going to have them available at the market this Saturday, 10 to 1, at the John Hansen Senior Hall. That's the market, and the Flower Farm will be there with bouquets. Up next, it's High Country Music with Lars Christensen. He's got your High Country Music till 4 o'clock. Then it's All Things Considered, and at 4:30, a local newscast. With Alaska News Nightly after that at 6 o'clock.
Nothing a homegrown tomato won't cure. Put them in a salad, put them in a stew. You can make your very own tomato juice. You can eat them with eggs, you can eat them with gravy. Eat them with beans, pinto or navy. Put them on a side, put them in the middle. Put a homegrown tomato on a hot cake griddle.
Homegrown tomatoes, homegrown tomatoes. What would life be without homegrown tomatoes? Only two things that money can't buy. Homegrown tomatoes.
tomato seed. 'Cause I know what this country needs. It's homegrown tomatoes in every yard you see. When I die, don't bury me in a box in a cemetery.